Hi, and welcome to another episode of Conversations About Running, the podcast from Running Trips. Running Trips are the company behind Kenya Experience and Training Focus Camps, UK training weekends for competitive runners of all levels. In today's episode, Callum and I are joined once again by Coach Hugo Vandenbroek. Hugo is a hugely experienced coach and former professional runner who has lived in Iten, Kenya for more than a decade. As an athlete, Hugo has a 2:12 marathon personal best, and since retiring from competitive running, has turned his hand to coaching. He now coaches both elite and non-elite runners on the ground in Iten and across the world. In today's episode, we discuss the altogether disappointing situation coming out of the Bowerman Track Club in the United States regarding Shelby Houlihan's positive drug test. We then delve into the training of Dutch superstar and Hugo's former international teammate, Sifan Hassan, before taking a look at Callum's recent PB over 5,000 metres. Hugo is Callum's coach, and we discuss what went right for Callum on this occasion and what other athletes can learn from that, with Hugo sharing some interesting research on pain and pain perception. We also find time to joke about Hugo's musical tastes and to try and end the ongoing debate between Gavin and Callum as to who would win a head-to-head race. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy the show. Hugo Vandenbroek is back on the podcast.
Yeah. Hey, how are you guys?
Yeah, doing all right. So you know that we had a couple of episodes with, we abandoned you for a couple of episodes.
Yeah, that was great actually.
Yeah,
thank you.
You were happy there. Did you?
Well, no, just kidding.
Did you listen to them?
Actually, I didn't. I'm very, I don't know if lazy is the right word, but I'm not so good with listening to podcasts. I always like to do it, but I have time to just sit down for 1 hour or more and listen to a podcast. Because I'm always, you know, doing something. I'm taking my daughters to school, and I'm going for a run, then I'm working, then I'm picking them up, then I'm working again, then, you know, I have to feed them.
Yeah, I think it would probably fall into the category of, like, personal development or, like, you know, like...
Oh, yeah. Bettering
yourself as a person.
I did a lot of that last year, actually, from when Corona started, from March, April, May. So I spent a lot of time just, you know, learning stuff actually, and also listening to podcasts. But to be honest, lately I haven't been able to. But I really want to hear the last one with Bergen.
Matt.
Am I right? Matt,
yes,
Bergen.
Matt.
Yeah. He's a physio, right? Physiotherapist.
Yes, physio, yeah.
13 something runner on 5K, 13:45 or so.
Yeah, thereabouts. 40 something, I'm not sure exactly what.
Okay, but yeah. So I really want to listen to that one, and I think what I'm just going to do, I'm going to put it on a stick, and then when I'm driving,
yeah, that's normally a good time for it. Yeah, if you're driving,
instead of, you know, listening to Bruno Mars singing his songs or so, I can.
Kenyan radio is pretty good.
Yeah, not bad. Hugo, for sure.
When Hugo said Bruno Mars, he wasn't actually joking. I remember, like, probably around a year and a half ago, I got, like, kind of a random message from Hugo just saying, man, have you ever listened to Bruno Mars? He's actually a really amazing artist. I really love Bruno Mars. I was like, yeah.
This is the guy. Okay, so I haven't listened to him, but I think I do know who he is. But this is the guy who would jump in front of a train for you.
Yeah.
Shoot off his left eye for you. This is that guy.
Yeah, that's the guy.
Okay,
right. That's a terrible song for sure. But I did realize that he's a genius as an artist. I don't know why I send that to you, Callum, but for sure I like Bruno Mars because of the variety of his songs, and he's a genius, to be honest.
I'll send you some I don't know what. What do you reckon, Callum? What does Hugo need from the UK music scene?
Some Arctic Monkeys, for sure.
Yeah, he certainly needs some Arctic Monkeys.
Okay.
Do you know that, Hugo?
Never heard of.
You've never heard of Arctic Monkeys?
Arctic Monkeys? No.
Yeah.
There are no monkeys in the Arctic, right?
No, I think it's no. Your response to their band name is similar to Liam Gallagher's, who said that I don't know if it's Liam or Noel Gallagher who said they'll never get anywhere with a name like that. yeah, they went on to do pretty well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What were you were asking about? Me about the podcast, if I was listening to the podcast.
Yeah. We've done another one just last week as well with James T. Have you heard of Coach James T?
I've seen him on your on Instagram, of course, and I think he was the reason that two people came to me and asked me like, "Hey, are you fired from the Kenya experience? Because there's another coach." Don't worry, I'm still there.
Okay, maybe we didn't make it clear enough. And Hugo is absolutely not replaced. James is coaching on our UK-based training focus camps, and Hugo is still our coach in Kenya.
I think that was pretty clear, but people didn't. Not everyone, you know. Social media is perfect for going very quickly through things without actually paying much attention. So,
James, you might enjoy that one as well, Hugo, because James is Jake Smith's coach. Do you know the young UK runner who did really well at World Half?
Okay, Kate Smith.
Jake Smith, the guy he got Jake quite Smith. A lot of publicity here recently because he did his first ever marathon in 2:11 exactly. He was supposed to be a pacemaker to 25K and he just decided to keep running.
Oh, wow. That's pretty good. Yeah.
He was helping. He was helping some other guys chase the Olympic qualifying standard in quite a low key race.
And then he beat them.
I think it was a lap course and each lap he just kept saying to the guys, "I'll take you one more lap. I'll take you one more lap." And then I think somewhere in the low 30s, he said, "Oh, by the way, I'm just going to try and finish." And then ran away and won. And that was with, right. His longest run before that day had been 18 miles.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
That was an interesting guy to coach as well. You've got a guy who... Well, they call him the Marathon Maverick now. They say it's a bit of a maverick move.
What's a maverick?
It's one of those words that's kind of easier. No, it's a good question. It's kind of easier to know it than to describe it. Callum, have you got a good description for it?
Someone who's quite impulsive, I would say.
You don't follow the rules, but not right, in a bad way. Not in a bad way. Like, yeah, you sort of, you carve your own path. You don't follow the standard.
Yeah, I get you.
Standard ideas, okay.
Yeah, I can kind of get an idea of that. Yeah. And is he a young guy? Young and upcoming?
Yeah, he's 22 now, I think James said.
He's 22, 23. Yeah, I think 22. But he only really became a real talent in the last couple of years. People started noticing him. He started producing some crazy workout. I think he's been running for quite a long time, but he was very low level.
That's a silly thing to say. Compared to what he's doing now, he was, just a sort of competitive club runner until a couple of years ago, and then really has really come on. You might enjoy that, but
Houlihan or
okay, no, I mean we can talk. The thing is, we can talk about that. But because this podcast probably... So this is... What day is it, Callum? It's Wednesday.
Yeah.
It's Wednesday, and this podcast probably won't go out until Saturday, Sunday, Monday. Anything we say might be completely out of date by then. Like, when things are moving quickly and new information comes out and... I don't know. I mean, that isn't what I was going to bring up.
Now that you've said that, anyone listening will understand if it is out of date. So we could maybe just...
Yeah. Okay. Well. Yeah. Go on then. Let's. I don't know. What are your thoughts? Because it seems to have split the public opinion quite significantly.
Yeah. I saw a very good thread on Twitter the other day actually, by I can't remember his name, but basically it was someone saying that
Tucker.
No, I don't think it was them. I'll try and find this and we can. I'll send you a screenshot or something after the podcast, but. Basically they were saying they kind of evaluate someone's performance when it comes to drugs and whether or not they think they're clean or dirty, because there's no real way of 100% telling really. They kind of evaluate it based on the number of red flags in inverted commas that they give them, and And there are a number of ways of getting red flags, and missing or failing a drugs test is one major red flag. It doesn't necessarily say, yes, you're 100% a cheat, or yes, you're 100% clean, but it is a major red flag that builds up that overall picture. And obviously there are other red flags, like running really, really fast. being a world beater in itself is, you know, partly a red flag. You know,
so I will let you continue, Callum, but I have had this conversation with my coach in the last 24 hours, and he sent me a detailed list of sort of his, essentially the same kind of thing you're talking about, his version of red flags. And we are both quite clear that running fast in itself is not one. Like there are lots of things that can go alongside it, which then make it a red flag. But I think it's important to say that being a world-class athlete in itself, at least under our assessment, was not a red flag. It had to go alongside something else. For instance, a massive improvement at an unusual time. I think he said, I'll let you carry on because you were halfway through yours.
It's Chris Jones is the
Chris Jones, guy. The physiologist.
I guess so. Yeah.
No. I'm thinking of Andy.
It's Andy Jones.
Yeah.
Sorry. No, it's Chris Jones. He does have Chris a PhD. Jones. He has a PhD in sports biomechanics. I'm just reading that off his Twitter, but anyway, yeah, he put up a quite a long thread, and it's quite, and it does kind of echo my thoughts. And to continue where I was at, he basically says that there are about maybe like a number of red flags, and then more and more red flags that any athlete builds up over time, the more likely he is to doubt their performance. And he kind of basically said that the Houlihan case is basically one massive red flag that will.
What are the red flags in her case then? Because I don't know enough about her to know.
Yeah. So my coach had it down as a massive red flag before even the silly burrito excuse. So then add in the silly.
But shall we? Shall we just quickly explain to Hugo what's actually, or for anyone listening, what actually this case is about?
I think Hugo knows what the case is about. I think he's asking you specifically what the red flags are.
I know that she tested positive for nandrolone, and I know it's weird that our coach said that he has never heard of nandrolone, because I think people who are in sports have at least heard of it. You may not know exactly what it is, but you've heard of it. But I was wondering if there are any red flags not related to this case, but more like about her performance or her improvement, or, you know what I mean?
Right, yeah. I think there has been a fairly sudden jump in performance over the last 2 years or something. I actually personally don't know enough about her as an athlete to cast judgment, but based on things I've read on other threads and things like that, I think there has been a significant jump in performance. The training load, new coaches or anything like that, I'm unsure, to be honest.
What was the major red flag then? Is that just mostly just related to the case itself?
Yeah. So the fact that she failed a test. not even that she just didn't show up for a test or anything like that. She had a test and failed it. I mean, the question is whether she's a clean athlete who's unlucky, or a dirty athlete with a bad story, you know? Not really sure.
I mean, by the sounds of it, none of the three of us are enough in this specific case to go through these red flags. I say we've read about them, and other people believe there are red flags there. But yeah, I mean, it doesn't sound like any of us have enough detail on it to actually sort of put forward what they are. So Callum, if you can find out that thread, and then people can have a look at it and then make their own assessment on kind of the red flags that might be not related specifically to this case. But for me, where the actual specifics of this situation come about, the story and the line that's being pushed by the athlete, the coach, and the teammates until a little bit more information, very specific information comes out, it's far from watertight, and it could go either way. Like, dependent on what some of the information comes out, it could either, to me, absolutely fall apart and just be like, well, that's absolutely laughable. Or it kind of strengthens the story and it's going, okay, yeah, you know what? Maybe that is, it is what they're saying, and it is a ridiculously harsh and unlucky situation. And for me, it pins on things such as what actually was her level of nandrolone and how does it relate to the level that triggers a positive test, because I've seen a lot of unsubstantiated summaries essentially saying trace amounts and a tiny bit over and normal amounts of food. But I haven't seen any actual, And then on the other side, I've seen people saying that she's massively over the limit and there's no way, you'd have to eat 3 contaminated pigs to get to that amount of, you know, like, and it's all coming from people with a vested interest one way or the other. And if it's true what the Bowman Track Club are saying, that you can trigger that, you can trigger a test through a normal amount of food, then that is different to if her levels were actually miles and miles above, which is what other people are reporting. So I think until I don't know whether that information does become public or is public, and if people with an agenda one way or the other are muddying the waters deliberately. But yeah, I think until that's known, to me, their excuse, I nearly called it excuse, it's showing sort of my own bias there. To me, their story hinges really on some of the facts that aren't actually out yet.
That's a very good point. That's very good, and that's very often what you see in doping cases. But for example, also in the case of Semenya, where everyone has an opinion about it, but in the end, very few people actually know the facts, right?
Yeah,
and it would be fair for all of us to say, like, without knowing the facts, let's just withhold any kind of judgment before we know more, right?
Yeah, for sure.
But it's being pushed so hard because then another bit for me, which, so in her own statement, she said, and I'm paraphrasing, I haven't got it in front of me, but she said, I can't remember if it's WADA or the Athletics Integrity Unit, whoever it is, says they are fully aware that contaminated pork could trigger a false positive. And she's using that as a, therefore, they should know that's what's happened to me. But you could just as easily read that as, therefore, they're ready for when an athlete comes up with that excuse and they have the science to be able to tell whether that's what's happened or not.
Well, the first thing I would think when you hear that statement is like, if you know this and you're a top athlete of that level, how stupid are you to eat pig?
Yeah.
You know, if you know that there's a chance, I don't know how big that chance is. Is it 1 in 1,000,000? Is it 1 in 100? If there's a chance that you can eat contaminated pig, contaminated meat, and you're going to eat some food from a burrito at a van, I mean, for regular people, this sounds like a normal thing to do. But for top athletes, that's not normal. I mean, you know, if it's true that this is indeed something that can easily happen, like, oh, you eat the wrong piece of meat and your nandrolone levels just go up like crazy. And I mean, normally, as you know, of course, like these kind of limits that they put when it comes to a positive test or a negative test, they are not very, very tight in a way that, you know, if a normal person scores, let's say, between 1 and 5, they are not going to put that limit at 6. They'll put it at 15 or 20, you know, at an outrageously high amount that they know, like, okay, there's only one way that you can have this amount, and that is true if you do it purposely. It's not like, okay, you're a genetic outlier, or, you know, because of high altitude training, or, you know, whatever. They are normally going to put that limit at a much higher amount.
Yeah, for sure. And that's essentially what I was trying to explain about the facts. I mean, I don't know the facts, and it's, as I say, the water's been muddied from both sides, and it's hard to tell. But my from what I've read, and I have no idea what units we're talking, the allowable limit is between 0.2 and 0.3. And then you've got one side of the argument saying that she had trace amounts above that limit with no specification of what that means. And the other side of the story saying that she was at 5 and the allowable limit's 0.2. So if you're at 5, I'm not saying she, what, I don't know. I've seen it said that she was at 5. It's very difficult to tell who knows what they're talking about and who doesn't. But yeah, if you're and then Hugo, I don't know if you're aware of this, but so then the second side, another side, sorry, of the statement is that, you know, our lawyer has shown this and this and this. And I guess that's, they're a legal expert, so that's supposed to strengthen your case. But it seems to me like, yeah, they also know all the loopholes and they know all the things that you might get off on.
Exactly.
And the burrito that they are saying that caused this, and they're like, we've got proof that she was there, we've got receipts, but the receipt doesn't show a pork burrito. The receipt, she ordered something else. So they're saying not only did she get it from this place, but this place messed up her order, gave her something she didn't order.
And that sounds already weird.
Exactly. And she didn't realize at the time that she was eating a completely different food to what she thought she was eating. But retrospectively, we know with absolute certainty that that's what caused it.
Yeah. So you're somewhere, you're ordering food, you get something else, you don't realize that it's something wrong. It never happened to me in my life, but it could potentially happen. And then the one time in your life that happens, that stuff makes you to test positive.
Yeah, exactly.
The wrong stuff that you were accidentally getting was contaminated and you had a drugs test in the following hours.
Yeah, it's
quite unlikely.
Well, yeah, this is exactly.
The combination of circumstances.
So, and this is where it goes. Like, you then have this situation where potentially she is the world's most unlucky athlete, and as her coach says, she's being treated hideously unfairly. But from what we can see at the moment, that seems to be really, really unlikely. Which is. It's just terrible for this, like, the sport the sport just continues to shoot itself in the foot week after week
If this is the case also, then any athlete could say they had contaminated meat. I mean, if the only proof she has is that she ordered some food, but then they say, okay, the food that she ordered wasn't what was contaminated, but wasn't even what she got, wasn't what she ate something else.
Yeah,
I mean, if that's your proof, right, then anyone could say, like, okay, I was having dinner at my house, and I have no evidence but what I ate, but I know I ate pork, and probably that contaminated.
Exactly. But that, what you've just described, that is the line that Bowerman Track Club and all the coaches and athletes are pushing, are, if this has happened to us, this could happen to you. Like, don't, you know, be scared of the system, be worried about the system. The system's the problem. We're innocent, you're innocent. So next week it could be you. And again, I mean, rightly or wrongly, I think a lot of people are falling on the side of the argument where they agree with that, and they think that's the case, and they have a lot of sympathy for the athlete.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. Who knows? I think it's a shame that these things dominate the sport, and this is the issue that makes, like, Jakob Ingebrigtsen breaking the European 5K record, I don't think got a mention on the BBC, but this gets on the front page. Neither of the two women's 10K world records, I didn't see them in the mainstream media. But this will be. I don't know. I just think there's so much negative news comes out of athletics, and it's
From my side, I had read about those three things, the European record from Jakob Ingebrigtsen and, of course, the two 10K world records. But I had not yet heard about Shelby Houlihan until you guys told me yesterday. So,
I mean, it only came out yesterday as well. Like, we were pretty quick off.
Okay. Right. But anyway, it's not all that bad, but I agree with you that it's often the negative stories that are the most dramatic.
Yeah.
and that have people talking like us now. We talk about it, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
It's interesting, and of course, it says it is interesting because it's not just about that single athlete, but it's about a system and about whether it's fair and if it's indeed something that can happen to all of us.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like sure. me, but, no. Yeah. But also it's a group that's on the main, very highly respected. Yeah, they got a lot of fans. They got a lot of athletes that people are rooting for from multiple countries. And yeah, I don't know. And then is it then guilt by association? Are other people in that group then suspicious? Is it a rogue athlete working without the knowledge of the coaches and the other athletes? Or is it just complete bad luck? And yeah, they're all now being unfairly tarnished. It's difficult to say. Yeah. Sorry, Cal, you were going to ask something.
No, I was basically going to change the subject. I was interested to hear Hugo's thoughts on Sifan Hassan's performance since Sifan stayed with Hugo not too long ago in A10. So yeah, I was just interested to hear his thought about her breaking the 10K record and also her 1500 meter performance not too long after as well, which was also pretty spectacular.
Well, I mean, it's not like I know Sivan personally very, very well.
Better than most of us.
Well, yeah, maybe. I mean, I first met her in 2010 at the... is that correct? 2014. What was supposed to be my last race, the European Championships. In Zurich, Switzerland, and I was supposed to run the marathon there, but I got injured just before that. I went there, but I didn't actually compete, unfortunately. And I met Sifan there. We had several times breakfast or lunch together. And the first thing I realized, actually immediately, the few times that I met her, was that she is an extremely focused athlete and extremely, she has a very, very strong desire to win. When she in her first race there, she got silver. I think that was the 5,000 meters. She got beaten by another athlete from Sweden, and she was so angry, so incredibly angry that she didn't win gold. And I could see that was not an act. She was not playing. She was seriously very, very upset. And you couldn't talk with her actually on that time. And then of course she went on to win gold in her second event, the 1500. I hope I don't mess them up. I think it was gold in the 15 and silver in the 5,000. And anyway, what I noticed this time when she came to E10 and stayed in our guest house is the same focus. You know, more than any other athlete, her life is 100% about running, and it's nothing else. And yeah, I understand in general, you know, when she does workouts, she goes as hard as she can. And she even tries to beat Kajelcha, Joseph Kajelcha. Of course, he's the world record holder, I think, in the mile. And
right.
she seriously believes that she can beat him one day. And she has no limits. She is super aggressive in her running. With aggressive, I mean in a good way. Like she's willing to suffer.
She attacks her workouts.
She goes for it from the start and pushes hard. And yeah, I could see that focus that she has. And I was not, in that way, I was not surprised. I mean, we've seen, of course, how she became a world champion in the 10,000 meters and 1500. And I was not surprised that she broke the world record in the 10,000. I mean, I estimated her to be a 14 flat 5K runner at her best shape. And with a 14 flat 5K, you can run about 29 flat on a 10K. And I still think that Sifan can run under 29 minutes. I mean, she ran about 20 laps or so of the 25 she ran by herself.
Yeah.
I still believe she can run under 29 minutes. And of course, that would be incredible. But I think that's what I think both her and Tegay, I'm not sure I pronounced that correct, Tegay or Tegi, the Ethiopian athlete, who
she ran broke 29.01 or something, right?
901, yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that guy is another incredibly focused and incredibly talented athlete. I remember first seeing her when she was not personally seeing her like Sifan, but I would see her on TV when she was 17 years old, and she was running the world junior cross country championships, and I think she got second in that race. But she ran so beautifully and so like it looked so comfortable, and she was like 2 years younger than all the other athletes. And later, she won. I think the next year or the 2 years, she won. She became the world champion, and I'm not surprised to see that both Sivan and Teke are in this level of basically a 14 flat, 29 flat. So yeah, I think it will be between the two of them. We will have we will finally have the longest standing world record.
Yeah, Sifan has an incredible range as well, because she ran a couple of weeks later 1500 in 3:53, which is
days later, which is
close to the pretty close to the world record for 1500 as well. So does that come down to her like attitude or training or just her as an athlete? What I mean, not many people have that kind of range for 1500 and 10k.
Yeah. That's true.
You could argue that Mo had it at a certain time.
I mean, yeah, very true. Very true. I mean, you couldn't even argue that, but he definitely did. He ran.
The reason I said you could argue it was that he wasn't world number one at 1500. Like he was pretty close, but he wasn't world number one. But yeah, she's currently. I think I'm correct in saying she's currently world number one.
Yeah, world lead. Yeah, world lead.
Right, yeah, and I guess she's not world number one for 10K anymore. But, but pretty close.
Yeah. I think you're right in that way, exactly. Like, Mo had an incredible range, but no one would expect him to be the world champion in 1500 or the mile, something, you know, or to break a world record. But he was really good, of course, in 1500 also.
You have to wonder what she must have, speaking still of Sifan, she must have some difficult decisions to make with the Olympics approaching, because if you pick the 10K, you're going up, you're going in potentially not as the favourite. But yeah, whereas the 1500, I think it's so far been suggested that she'd try for the 5K, 10K double.
I thought so, yeah.
And potentially the 1500, the event you won't be doing, will be the only event that you'd go in as the outright favourite for.
yeah. But I think that might be her character also, that she wants to prove that she can do that. So I think when it comes to, when you ask about her range, my idea is that her training is very speed-based, very much based on running fast repetitions at 1500 meter speed, 800 meter speed, 3K speed. She is, as far as I know, she's not someone who does a lot of longer reps, you know, like for me as a marathon runner, if I would prepare for a 10K, I would do a session like 6 times 1600 at my 10K race pace, for example, right? That would be a pretty specific session, or 2K reps at my 10K race pace. I don't think Sivan does a lot of that, or maybe even nothing of that, but she does a lot of shorter reps, up to 800 meters and very fast. Where she gets her endurance from is that she hardly ever runs easy. Her easy runs are at around 330 per K, which is 540 per mile or so. So she gets her endurance, her aerobic stimulus she gets from her easy runs, which aren't easy. It's like zone three, lower zone three, higher zone two, I would say, when you're thinking in five zones.
Dun, dun, dun. Is she outside the magic 80-20?
yeah. There's no 80-20 here. That's like the gray zone. She does a lot in the terrible gray zone that you should never use.
You cannot possibly run well if you don't follow 80-20.
Yeah. I'm very sure about that. I mean, I don't want to mention all the secrets of Sivan Hassan's training, but one thing I can say is that she does a lot in the forbidden zone, which is a higher zone to low zone three. For sure. That's where
I saw something. It was fresh in my mind because I saw something just this morning. I don't know who it was. I was wasting time scrolling on the internet, and it was just yet another post with thousands and thousands of likes and hundreds of comments about how you must not run. Your easy runs must be 2 minutes per mile slower than your 10K pace, and then everything else must be faster than marathon pace, and anything between those two, you're wasting your time and you're killing your, you know, your, yeah. So yeah, it's just fresh. But yeah, I don't know.
People often say, yeah, what they want to say it in a, like, in a nice way. They say you don't get a lot of bang for your buck. Eh? Like, you put into it, but you don't get a lot of quality or a lot of return for it, which, yeah. I mean, we've discussed this before, and I really don't see any reason, not scientifically, not from experience, to say that is correct. You know, I don't see that. I mean, we all know that if you're preparing for a 10K race, of course, you're not going to do lots of training in your zone 3 and forget about your zone 4 and 5, obviously, right? But if you're training for a marathon, then maybe that's exactly the zone you want to do. So, yeah. So, and yeah, like I just said, Sifan Hassan does a lot in that zone, you know. So she also does a lot in her zone 5, of course. I mean, all her track workouts, yeah, they're all at 5K race pace and faster, basically. Not to say, she will probably do something in 10K race pace, but she's not someone who does like the, typically what 10K race, what 10K athletes do is like longer reps at their 10K race pace. I don't think she does much of that, or maybe even nothing.
No, that's interesting. Yeah, so there is one other sort of almost elephant in the room that I want to bring up before we get talking.
So what was the other elephant in the room you were about to bring up, Gav?
Oh, yeah. So my original elephant in the room, which actually now, as I almost brought it up again a few minutes ago, Hugo, when you were talking about athletes who are in 14 flat shape. So my elephant in the room is, why is Callum so desperate to record a podcast this week when like we shouldn't really be recording until next week? So I'm just wondering, like, what's happened that makes Callum so enthusiastic to talk to us now?
What could it possibly be? I feel like we should have done this in the other order, because we've just gone from talking about the world's best athlete, and now it was like we're like, oh, okay, and now over to you, Callum. What have you been up to? Like, yeah. Well, anyway, so it's I think last time we were all together, us three, we were talking about one of my terrible races. It didn't go the way I wanted, and yeah, it's just all round kind of bad. And we were trying to draw some positives out of it. But yeah, so really pleased to say that this time I had a very good race. Ran a personal best in Watford at the BMC Grand Prix of 14:05 for the 5,000 metres. So yeah, big step in the right direction.
Yeah, so I'm guessing that was a happy athlete and happy coach.
Yeah, very. I'm always fairly reserved about the shape I'm in, as in like when I'm talking to other people, you know, inevitably people are saying, oh, what are you aiming for? What's your target? What kind of shape are you in? I'm usually, in previous seasons, I'm quite good at telling people my genuine shape. You know, I'd say, right, I think I'm going to run this time. And I do run that time. So this year, I've come into this season and I've been kind of telling people, I think I can break 14 minutes. I think I'm in 14 minute shape. So then when I had those two first races of the season where I ran, I think 14:31 and 14:33, one on the track and one on the road, I was kind of getting a bit like embarrassed that I had told people that I think I'm in 14 minute shape. So yeah, when I crossed the line this time, it was, to be honest, relief. I actually am in the shape I thought I was, and not quite under 14, but it was enough of a step and enough of a leap forward that I was very happy with that.
So what was different in this race from the last couple?
Honestly, not a huge amount. I was speaking to some guys after the race and I was saying it's difficult to describe, but I'll do my best. It's when you're running at that like intensity and you know you're really at the limit of what you think you can achieve, it can really easily go one way or the other. Like you're literally running on a knife edge, and it's
literally
you're metaphorically running on a knife edge, and it gets to a point, for me, happens around 3.5 to 4K into the race, where it really could go one way or the other. And I don't know if hopefully people listening now can also recall the last time us three were in a podcast together, we spoke about a few of like a few of the mental cues and the mental things you can do to help kind of push through that, while stay focused and push through the pain and get to the end of the race feeling good, basically. And like, it sounds like I'm just bigging up our own podcast, but genuinely, the last podcast we did, and I haven't actually spoken to Hugo about this yet, so this is me also reporting to my coach in real time. I really used what we spoke about in the last podcast, and that was that really try and stay in the moment. So when it hurts, don't think about your like previous training. Don't think about what time you're going to cross the line in. Don't think about, am I going to run a PB? Don't think about, just think about where you are right now, how you can keep running at the pace you're running at, keep pushing it. And one thing Hugo said to me, or he said in the last podcast, was just try and think of the current lap that you're on. And I've, in the last few weeks, I've practiced it in easy runs. Just when I've been running around on the grass, I thought, can I bring it down even finer than that? So why think about the lap I'm on? Because a whole lap, that's still quite, you're kind of still thinking ahead at that point. You know, if I'm thinking about my lap, that's a whole almost 70 seconds of running I've got to think about. So I tried to bring it even finer than that. And every time the pain hit, I literally counted my strides. I was going 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2 in my head. And I just tried to keep the focus on that for as long as I possibly could and not think of anything else. And inevitably, you kind of only, you can really do that for maybe 15 or 20 seconds before your mind starts going to another place or something. But then every time the pain hit again and I thought, oh, I can't do this, I got rid of those thoughts by just going 1, 2, 1, 2, counting my strides. Mm. And it really helped. Like, really, like, just, and I think probably a big part of why I ran 30 seconds difference between my last track race and this track race is because I wouldn't say I was in any better shape. I would say I just, the last track race, I got to that point where it was hurting and then it fell apart. This race, I got to the point where it was hurting and I was able to push through it. And yeah, I think that's,
that's a really interesting insight. I mean, I'm really into the mental side of things, and that's really fascinating to hear you talk about that, but leave that aside for 1 second. Do you think there's also, and this question's to your coach here as well, I mean, do you think there is also a physical aspect in there that you've 2 or 3 weeks previously, you've been in that same position before, and a physiological adaptation has also occurred? Like, you're not in better shape per se, but you're now ready to handle that, the physicality of running at that pace for that long, just by nature of having done it and failed, inverted commas, a couple of weeks before.
Yeah, it did feel like that. And we also got in a few sessions at like 5k intensity as well in that time. The last time I raced 5,000 meters on the track, I had done quite a few 5,000 meter sessions, but it was mainly off the back of like winter base training, really. Mm. So we hadn't had that many specific workouts, and probably another 3 weeks, we managed to get a few more specific workouts in, which combined with the race itself. And I had another 5K road race where I really dug deep in that race as well. I was close to blacking out, I would say. Mm. So yeah, probably those two occasions where I've really gone to my limit helped me. Yeah, it helped
my experience. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, go on. I thought you were finished.
No, I was gonna say, just it helped me re-find my limit again. Mm. Kind of like helped me know where I was and how to push myself.
My experience, not just of myself but just observationally with other athletes and athletes that I used to coach, was if you're peppering that same time over and over again, and I know you only did it twice, but it was pretty consistent, wasn't it? It was
mm.
that normally suggests to me that there's a big one coming. If you're up and down and you're all over the place, maybe not, because maybe one of those ups was already the big one. But if you're able to identify something that wasn't quite right that day, like say for instance on the first track race, you reported that you were, mentally you maybe weren't quite ready for that intensity of race. The road race, you ran pretty much the same time, but it was fairly miserable conditions, and everyone in the race was a bit down on what they might have expected. But you really raced hard. and you hit a very consistent time on both of them. Yeah, I mean, that would often suggest to me that, yeah, there's one coming.
Yeah, I think so. And it did kind of feel like that as well. Like it felt like, okay, these two races have been, yeah, consistently there. And also neither of them were, for me, neither of them were terrible times. So that the fact that I had kind of ran badly in inverted commas and still ran 14:30 or thereabouts did, yeah, always indicated to me that I was still in the kind of shape I thought I was, which was around 14:08.
So Hugo, what are your thoughts, one, on Callum's race specifically, and two, is that about what you expected? Did you expect more in the early season races? Or is that just part of the process?
Yeah, very good question, Gavin. The first race of Callum, I was a little bit disappointed, to be honest, because with the training he had done, I was thinking, I knew it was the first race of the season, but I was still expecting or hoping to see something like a 14:20 5K. So when he ran 14:33 or something, and he really died after 3K. Yeah, of course, I wasn't too happy with that, but I still, you know, we both felt like, okay, this is not his level and there's nothing wrong with the training. It's okay, you know, we just keep having confidence and we continue and the time will come. And the second one, when Callum ran again 14:31 in the road race, we talked a bit about it. And then I think, Callum, you wrote me something like, I'm just going to do it. Next time, I'm going to do it. And it just sounded so confident and you were sure of yourself. And it also gave me confidence that, okay, next time he's going to nail it. I know. And I was not 100% sure, but as I told him, you know, I went to bed at 10 o'clock. I was quite tired. And then it's just 8 o'clock, I think, in the UK. He was running a bit later than that. But I put my phone next to me in bed because I was really excited. I felt like he's going to run really well and I want to know it. So I was waiting for the message to come in. Then I woke up, I saw the message, and then I was like, yes, he did it, you know. But yeah, I mean,
well, sorry, Hugo. So did you have that set to wake you up, or you just said the first thing you saw when you woke up?
No, I just made sure that I the internet was on, or that it. I checked it a few times, you know, to make sure that messages, the WhatsApp message would come in and I would hear that, you know, I can hear the message coming in. So then I would check it. Right.
what did Hilda think of that? is that taking coaching too far when you're interrupting?
She can sleep. No problem. She can sleep. She sleeps like, you know, very well. So it's not just
is that Callum again texting you at midnight?
It better be Callum, who's texting you at midnight, Hugo.
At least, male athlete, that's better.
Yeah.
But I was for sure. I had a feeling like Callum was going to do it, and I was not happy with the 14:10, and 14 flat or 14:02 was also possible, but 14:05 I was very happy. Other than what you guys said, as you know, I'm also very much into mental preparation and generally training mental aspects of running. But I also, a part of what we call mental aspects is something unconscious, something you can't control. Just like, how's it called again? Noakes theory, the central governor theory. This is something you can't control. And what I mean with that is, for example, like what Gavin kind of pointed out. So sometimes you have to go through certain races and the pain that comes with it, and maybe the level of, you know, lactate or other waste products in your body, whereby at some point your brain kind of pulls the handbrake and says like, okay, we're getting in the danger zone. Now this is getting tricky. And if you do that a few times, and like Callum really, really pushed very hard in that 5K road race, I'm very sure that that has impact on your level of pain tolerance. And that's something that is not really, not something you can really consciously control. right? So you, partly you can control it consciously, and that's what Callum did exactly, you know, by using mental tools to stay in the moment, to be not to lose focus by thinking negative things like, okay, you know, I might not run a personal best, or I'm going to die, it feels so painful. No, you keep being in the moment, you think positive, those things help. But there is a certain percentage that you can't control, where it's just, you know, your brain has to get used to that level of pain and be okay with it.
So Hugo, how moving away from Callum specifically for just for a moment, how would that apply to yourself, but also to other listeners maybe who aren't running 5,000 meters on the track, where they can have a couple of goes, go away for a week, come back, have another go? If you're running a marathon, for example, how do you achieve that same thing, whereby you're saying sometimes you just have to have gone through that pain and maybe not been able to deal with it to then next time be able to deal with it? Like if you're doing a marathon and you can't do another one for 6 months, 8 months, a year, how does that, yeah, does that apply, or how can you?
Yeah, it still applies, but it's harder. Like it does apply in races too. I believe that doing a marathon, especially when you're still starting, let's say you've done 3 or 4 marathons only, then every marathon, going through that experience, you know, going through the pain after 35K, you know, those last 7K, or what is it, 3.5 miles or so, 4 miles, going through that helps you for your next marathon. But like you say, you can only do that maybe twice a year. So of course you have your training sessions, you have your workouts, where, you have to push yourself, you know, and you break barriers in those training sessions. And of course you always have to balance that way, that you marathon training can be hard, but you shouldn't make it so hard that, you know, you get injured or you overtrain yourself. But of course there should be hard workouts. When I ran marathons, I would also do long runs of, you know, in the beginning maybe 30K, later up to 40 kilometers. When I ran my personal best in the marathon, I had done 2 marathons in the preparation, but just in training. So I would just go out and run a 42K and start relatively easy at 3:45, 3:40 per kilometer for me, and then progress to 3:30 per K, and then finish the last 5 or 8 kilometers at my marathon pace, which was about 3:10, 3:07 per K. So, and those were incredibly hard sessions. But I really felt like I needed them to do well in the marathon. I wouldn't have had confidence, you know, that I could run a very fast marathon by just doing easy long runs, for example.
Mm.
Yeah, so I did, during the marathon preparation, I did my long runs progressive, finishing at marathon speed. And there are also other workouts, of course. I don't know when it comes to pain. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that we don't know about it, actually, how our brain works. And I really don't know if one pain is very different from the other pain. I mean, if you're a marathon runner now and you do a session like 10 times 400 very hard, obviously that feels like a different type of pain than the type of pain of doing 5 times 3 miles at marathon speed. It's a different type of pain, but maybe any type of pain can be effective in dealing with race pain, if you know what I mean. So
so you're going to just start punching Callum in the face?
I can't remember if Hugo told the story of the chocolate bar on a podcast before. I can't remember if we'll be repeating.
I'm not familiar with it, so.
You know the chocolate bar, the athlete, Hugo?
Yeah. Oh, you mean with a friend of me who was, I think, 2:17 marathon runner, who said, I want to train my self-discipline, and you know, and then what he would do is he bought a big chocolate bar and put it up in his car. He would drive to his job and back and every and tell himself, I'm not going to eat it, and then he wouldn't eat it, and then he felt like he was training his self-discipline and ability to withstand, you know, how do you say,
like resist temptation.
Resist temptation.
I guess in a race, the temptation is to stop or slow down.
Yeah, just self-control generally, isn't it?
Yeah.
it's a fact for sure that athletes in general are better in dealing with pain than non-athletes. And this is not training pain. They're also better in that, of course. But simply when they get electric shocks, or when they have to put their hands in ice cold water, right?
So until 13 weeks ago, when I was in the maternity ward witnessing what giving birth is actually like, I used to have this, what I can now see was a very misguided idea, that the same as what you've just said also applied to childbirth, and that it's not that hard, because people just aren't, have never done anything hard in their life, so they like, I was like, yeah, but, because I said, like, well, yeah, but
yeah, but I ran a half marathon once, yeah, so exactly, I know what childbirth
exactly.
is like.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. No, but it was somewhat connected to that. I knew female runners who had given birth, and they had handled it like really well, and that had kind of perpetuated my idea that, like, yes, because they're tough, like they're runners, so they're hard, they know about how to deal with pain. So yeah, I just thought everyone else was just a bit of a wimp, but yeah, having now for the first time actually been in the maternity ward, and yeah, to some extent witnessed what mothers go through, yeah, I can report that I have updated my ideas on that subject.
I can imagine. Yeah. But what do I want to say? Well, there are, of course, differences between between top athletes and amateur athletes, and between amateur athletes when it comes to dealing with pain on a group level, at least, right? So I mean, that's interesting. I remember one study where they looked at swimmers. So they had a group of elite swimmers, a group of club swimmers, and then a group of non-competitive people. You know, they would do some sports, but not in a competitive way. So the club swimmers were still very competitive. They would train a lot and do races, but they weren't elite level. So when they compared those three and they let them do a pain test, I think it was an ischemic pain test where your the blood in your arm is like constricted, and then you have to pump your fist or something. So at some point it gets really painful. So there were three things that were really interesting for me. First of all, the elite swimmers could handle a lot more pain than the club swimmers, and the club swimmers could handle a lot more pain than the non-competitive swimmers. That's the first thing. Secondly, when they were asked about the pain, the club swimmers said that the pain that they felt during the test, during the ischemic, fist pumping test, they said the pain that they felt was the hardest pain they had ever felt in their life. Whereas the elite swimmers said, yeah, it was very strong pain, but the pain of training and racing was more painful. Training and racing, they described as more painful. And at the same time, those elite swimmers could handle a lot more pain during the pain test than the club swimmers. Know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
So they could handle a lot more pain, but they didn't describe it as a very strong pain. They said the pain of training and racing was even harder. So yeah, obviously they went through a lot more. They pushed themselves much more. They suffered much more in training and racing than the club swimmers. And the third thing that was interesting also was that what you saw with the elite swimmers was that they had three different scores on different on different moments in the year. In June, for example, when they were in their peak racing period, they could handle the most pain during that ischemic pain test. And when they were in, I think it was March, was like a pretty hard. They could handle that was like the second level, where they could handle less than during the racing season, but they could still handle quite a bit of pain. When they tested them in October, which was a resting period, they scored significantly lower. They still scored higher than the club swimmers, but a lot lower than during racing season. So in other words, there seems to be even a short-term adaptation, where in periods when you're training hard or when you're racing hard, even when you're tested in a completely different way of handling pain, handle more pain.
That is interesting and relatable, because I feel like in the winter, in the winter months, or this winter in particular, I was very good at kind of like just getting it done. Basically, I could go out and do training session after training session, but I wasn't that good at really pushing myself. Like if Hugo asked me to do, okay, like today we're going to do a really hard session, which don't come around that often in the winter, because it's more about just getting the consistent volume in. But if we did do a really hard session, I would find it very difficult to, yeah, both mentally and physically really, really push myself. Whereas now I feel like I'm much more comfortable in that same like pain threshold. I can, I can push through it and like it feels like the same level of pain. It's as painful, but I can
handle it. You just know it isn't, because you know what more you could do it other times. So I find it'd be interesting to see if other people have a similar thing or if there's any information on it. But for myself, I find there's other short term factors that influence my pain tolerance as well, and the way that I kind of know that or I'm aware of that is if I just go for sports massage or like specific treatment on a problem, if I'm hungry or tired, I hate it. Like I just can't stay still on the massage chair. I can't let the therapist like do their job essentially, just because I'm hungry. And then like because I'm hungry, I don't know if I'm agitated, but I just can't. But if I'm not, if I've had a decent meal and I'm not like physically tired whilst I'm there, then yeah, you just kind of grit your teeth, but you just accept it. But I know it's when I'm wriggling around and I'm like, that's painful, I know full well it's no worse than it is on another occasion, just because there are short-term factors influencing my ability to withstand it.
I've never heard of that before, but it does sound, there must be something scientific in that.
It's very common actually.
Right. I've never actually heard of that.
Specific to hunger or?
Yeah, to hunger and to tiredness. There is this, there's this scientist, I forgot his name. I have to check it out. I wrote about it in a chapter that I wrote about pain tolerance and about mental strength. But yeah, there's basically, there's research that supports that, where you know, if you're stressed for some reason, if you're hungry, if you're thirsty, if basically your basic needs are not met, then your mental strength is just a lot lower. So you will experience more pain, you will experience more tiredness. So yeah, hunger is one of those things, but there's other research done in very funny, you know, where they told people to look at a video of something that was kind of emotional. So we just watched that video, and they just told them, you're being recorded while you're watching the video, but nothing else. The second, so the other half of the group was told, try to control your emotions. Don't try to show any emotion. That was part of the group was told, don't show any emotion. And another part of the group was told, try to exaggerate your emotions. So if you're feeling sad, try to really show how sad you are. If you're feeling like excitement, try to show that, because you're being recorded. So when a time trial after that on the bike, those people who were just watching the video performed significantly better than those who were told to control their emotions. Yeah, it's quite interesting. Yeah, so something.
Yeah, so sort of the mental energy. I don't know if that's a real thing, but like the mental capacity that they'd used deliberately controlling their emotions had made them physically tired on the bike.
Yeah. And I read this it's like one of the most interesting books I read in the last few years. It's from Daniel Kahneman. Mm-hmm. He's a Nobel Prize winner. Psychologist, I think, and his book is called Thinking Fast and Slow. Really, I would recommend that book to anyone, Thinking Fast and Slow. So yeah, he, based on all the research, he concludes that basically we have a reservoir of mental strength, and that mental strength is used to push ourselves in It's used to lift a weight, but it's also used to control our emotions. It's used to make sure that, you know, we don't cheat on our partners. It's used to so that we control ourselves when it comes to eating or drinking. It's used in many different ways. And if you use it in one way, you lose a little bit of that mental energy, and it becomes harder to do something else. If you know what I mean, it's like a pool of mental energy that can be reduced, and it can be full and it can be half empty, and can be fully empty. And once you're drunk, it's probably fully empty, almost empty. When you're super tired because you went to bed late, it's also drained. It's also low. And the same thing, if you do a really hard workout, that pool of mental energy is also very low after that. So for us as runners, it's important to make sure that that pool of mental energy is full or almost full when we have our hardest workouts, and especially when we have our races.
Mm. Yeah, right? That's really interesting. And for me, that reiterates essentially why I do meditation. I haven't really thought of it in those terms, but it's one of the main reasons, as I understand it, and as it helps me, is for not controlling your emotions, but for not getting carried away by them. Accepting them. That's probably a better term for it. Acceptance of, like, when something bad happens, you don't get too down about it. And when something good happens, you don't get so excited about it. But it's difficult to explain, because that almost sounds like you're deliberately missing out on the good stuff and holding back on the bad stuff. So yes, it's more of an it's difficult. Do you understand what I mean, Hugo? Like, it's more.
Yeah, I totally understand what you mean. You try to make sure that the emotions don't overwhelm you. I mean, we all have our emotions, but I think what you see with a lot of elite runners, not only runners, elite sports people in any field, is they know how to control their emotions a bit in that way. The way you describe, where you don't want to be overwhelmed by your emotions in a way that it takes away a lot of your energy.
Yeah, exactly that. So let's go back to Callum then before we wrap up. Great race at the weekend. What's next, and does that change anything? Because I know, Cal, you still got a lot of ambitions at sort of the shorter distances as well, but does it? What sort of feelings stir up for you when you hear Hugo say earlier that if you can run 14 flat, you can run 29 flat?
I'm pretty sure I can't run 29 flat. I really feel like 5K is kind of the top end of my endurance. I would say the sweet spot for me is 3K. That's my perfect distance. And I enjoy 1500, and I'm quite good at 1500, and I'm quite good at 5K. But when it goes up to 10K, then it's a different ball game for me.
well, what do you think, Hugo?
Well, yeah, Callum is correct. Although I also I think that is partly also there's a mental aspect there with it, of Callum having enough confidence to know that he can do it. I agree that for Callum, flat 29 flat doesn't really count. He's more like a fast twitch 5K runner, but I still believe he can run 29:30, which is still a very good 10K. He wouldn't run under 29 right now, maybe, but I still think 29:30 is possible. And I think as he gets older, he will get better at the 10K also.
Now that you said that, I might have to have a go at it.
Yeah, but time is on your side, though, isn't it? So what then is the plan going forward from here? And has anything changed in that regard now that you have kind of reconfirmed that you are in the shape you thought you were in?
Yeah, kind of, because originally my plan was to only have those two 5Ks at the beginning of the season. So I was going to do the 5K 5K track race in Trafford a couple of weeks ago, and then the 5K road race. And I was hoping that would be enough that I could kind of sit back and relax, knowing that I had some good 5Ks and move on to some 1500 meter work. But we kind of added this 5K in as an emergency last minute 5K to try and get a good time. Now that I'm a bit more satisfied with my 5000 meter time, we're going to move on to some 1500 meter training, I think. So I'm going to, the next 3 or 4 weeks or so, we're going to have just a good block of training, not really interrupted by races. Because racing does kind of, although it does contribute to the overall process and the training, and the racing is important for middle distance runners, it can interrupt training in that you have to, if you want to have a really good race, you need to taper for it, and you probably need a little bit of recovery time after the race, and the race day itself isn't an ideal training session. So we're going to have 3 or 4 weeks of just 1500 meter training really, and then some shorter races in July and August, I think.
Yep.
You're happy with that plan, Hugo, or that's your plan in the first place?
Well, yeah, we made that plan together, but I agree. I mean, I know 5K racing is although Callum, yeah, he says he enjoys it. I would say he enjoys 1500 more.
Yeah, definitely.
and it's not about all about what you, also about what's important, and he's of course willing to do it, and he does it very well also on the 5K. But yeah, I agree that now it's time to go to the 1500, although. I would be happy if Callum could have a go at one more 5K at the end of the season. If there is a good evening race, you know, it's often quite hot in July and August, which makes it much harder to run a good 5K. But if we are lucky to find a good race in the evening and when it's a bit cool, and then it would be nice to have one more 5K towards the end of the season. But for the rest, we focus on the 1500 now. Yeah.
How do you think 1500 training would affect a five? So let's say now we move over to 1500 training, and that's the focus for the rest of June, July, and August. And then let's say I find a 5K race at the end of July. Do you think the fact that I've focused on 1500 training for the last 6 weeks or so would affect the 5K race? Or positively or negatively?
I think in your case it could affect it negatively. Right. If we completely forget about, you know, longer reps and threshold stuff. But that's not my plan. I would still keep a little bit of that in it, because I also feel like your 1500 benefits from it. But yeah, it would definitely impact the training a bit. I mean, if we there's two scenarios. In one scenario, you would do only 1500 meter races. And in the second scenario, there would be a 5K race at the end. In the second scenario, training would be slightly different, because I would still make sure there are some workouts specifically for that 5K, and make sure maybe an extra long run or an extra threshold or sub threshold session to make sure you have a very good endurance. I mean, for the 1500 with a less than 4 minutes race, if you don't do much endurance stuff for 6 weeks, it's not a very big deal.
Yeah, that's true.
Presumably, though, if you're thinking the 1500 is your main event, at some point you're thinking you're going to be doing more than one 1500 over say a weekend or even a couple of days period. Because I mean, I don't know, maybe you're not there this summer, but going forward, you're going to be looking to qualify for things like British Champs and what have we. And then does that then influence training? If you're saying, yeah, the race only takes 3 minutes and 40 something seconds, but if you have to do that back to back on consecutive days, or is that something that has to come into the thought process as well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course. I mean, that definitely matters. You don't want the national championships to be the first time that your athlete runs 2 days in a row something hard. So you want to be sure that you do that sometime before that also. But you can't do it too often, of course, because it's there's an injury risk. Or a little bit of overtraining risk, but definitely I think it's something important to consider.
Hugo, thanks a lot. I think that's probably, unless there's any sort of particular final thoughts on the subject, I think we've covered some interesting sort of hot topics, and then had a decent analysis of Callum's race and some of the training implications of that for Callum and other people. yeah. From my perspective, that's a good place to wrap up. But I don't know if either of you two have got any sort of final thoughts on what we've discussed today.
Nothing much from me. I just wanted to kind of point out that although I'm running kind of 14 minutes low for 5K, I feel like what we've spoken about is applicable to pretty much everyone. So, everyone racing competitively, I think, you know, people can draw a lot from what we've spoken about today and implement it into their own training. So don't think that, yeah, what we're talking about is, you know, for fast, in inverted commas, runners only. This can be applicable to anyone who's trying to get the most out of their training.
Yeah, for sure. I think that feeling that you speak about, that you hit it sort of 3.5K into a 5K, I think that's pretty similar whether you're on track for sub 13 or sub 22.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's gonna bite you at the same point, and you've got to fight. Maybe that's not the right word for it. You've got to find a strategy to get through it.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Hugo, final thoughts?
Well, I think the discussion about who is faster, you or Callum, is now finally settled.
No. Okay.
You'll come back mentally so much stronger than before, and you just run flat like it's nothing.
I think I will struggle to match Callum ever again over anything 5K and below. I don't know. I'm getting older. My motivation is going in the opposite direction in terms of the events that I want to be good at.
Right.
I don't know if I'll ever even race on the track again. I would like to, but if I didn't, it wouldn't be that big a deal to me. Can I run an equivalent performance better than 14:05? Yeah, maybe.
What would you say that is in a marathon?
It's very difficult to say, because this is one of the issues that I actually see in the UK in particular. So using the UK as an example, I think our conversion rate from 5 and 10K to marathon is really poor. And I think as a country, I think we've got a really, really good depth at sort of 800 through to 10K. Mm. I mean, just take, for example, I know that A race wasn't actually that much quicker than your race at the weekend. But generally speaking, we've got a lot of guys who can run around what you've run and faster.
Yeah, I think 14:05 ranked me about 45th or 46th or something in the UK. So
and we're only partway through the season. Like and I think if you looked at the 45th best marathon time, it would be way down in the 220s. And I don't think they're even close to equivalent time. So I don't know. I know there are charts and ways that various people have tried to work that out. Absolutely off the top of my head, 14 flat. I think if I ran
201, 202.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know, Hugo. You're more experienced at this than me. What would you say?
I would say probably 215.
Yeah, I was gonna guess at 17. Witness world
record 5K. Witness world record in the marathon.
currently there's no question that that is a better performance than anything I've put out there so far. I'm not going to argue that, but no, I'm not giving up that I may still have that in me at some point in the future. So yeah, I still think if we need to meet at middle ground, Cal, and middle ground is going to be somewhere around sort of 12, 13 miles.
Yeah, it's a half marathon then, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Hugo messaged me probably around this time last year saying he reckons I'm in 65 and a half minute half marathon shape. I've never actually ran that. I've never ran that, but I think that's good enough evidence in itself.
Yeah, okay, yeah. If your coach is trying to boost your confidence, tells you can run 65, then, I mean, I'd probably email Power of 10 straight after this.
I'll send them a screenshot of that message.
Yeah.
I think that was without considering Vaporflies or Alphaflies, so now would be like 64 low.
Yeah. Okay. Well. Again, we're with a decade old PB of 68 high, I'm nowhere near ready to take that on. So. But we will see what the future does bring.
Yeah. Nice.
Thanks, guys.
Right, guys. Yeah. Thanks a lot. Yeah, I really appreciate your time, Hugo. Good to catch up. And thanks very much. Hugo, it's always good to remind people, in case we've got first-time listeners, where people can learn more about yourself and what you're up to coaching-wise.
Callum and I work together as coaches, and people can find us on our website, trainsmarterrunfaster.com, and can also follow us on Instagram or Facebook on Train Smarter, Run Faster.
Yep. Awesome. And then obviously Hugo is also our head coach at Kenya Experience. If people want to come out and spend a couple of weeks with Hugo in the home of champions in the 10, then you can visit our website at www.traininkenya.com, or alternatively, you can visit www.runningtrips.co.uk, which has information about both our Kenya and our UK-based running camps.
Thanks for listening to Conversations About Running. I'm Gavin Smith, the founder of Running Trips, and today I was joined by my colleague Callum Jones and Hugo Vandenbroek, who is our head coach for the Kenya Experience camps in Attend Kenya. If you're interested in either our Kenya Experience running camps or our new UK-based training focus camps, then please head to www.runningtrips.co.uk to learn more. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, please do tell your friends and clubmates and help us spread the word a little further. Thanks as always go to Saucony, who are supporting training focus camps, as well as to Hugo for joining us from Kenya. Thanks again, and we look forward to next time.